Good afternoon, this time with the correct slide. So last time we finished up sort of our very brief overview of out-of-order processors, and we mentioned that we had sort of multiple ways we could execute instructions, and we had these different sort of execution units, which for arithmetic instructions would be like different ALUs. We have this more general term because there's instructions that don't just do arithmetic, like instructions that access the data cache. Basically, we have some number of slots to run instructions once we've actually done the preprocessing step of doing renaming and so on. And to make that work, we needed to figure out, okay, we have a list of instructions, how do we actually dispatch them? So we knew what slots we had, and we'd have a list of pending instructions, and we'd also track what registers were available, and because we did register renaming, we could just track yes or no, this register is available. We'd match that against our list of pending instructions, and we could figure out which instructions have all their inputs available. And we just find as many of those as we can, try to assign them to slots. If we run out of slots, too bad. If we don't find any instructions, we just let the slot not do anything, even though our processor has the capability of doing more. And we just do that kind of eagerly every cycle, looking for as much work that we can start as possible. And we hopefully end up making good use of our execution units, sort of doing the most work we can do. We learn that it turns out with many real programs, we'll run out of work because just because we have like 20 instructions ready to run in the sense of, translated, that doesn't mean they're actually ready to run. We know what they are, but we need to have their inputs available, and often they'll come from other instructions because if you think of much common code, you're doing something where you're computing something, then using the thing you just computed to compute the next thing. That's not going to benefit that much from out-of-order processors. So we also mentioned that we had some more complex instructions that it wasn't actually obvious how we deal with the out-of-order processor design. So one example was instructions that like use the stack, or instructions that like access memory and do arithmetic. How would we make those instructions possible? And a strategy that is very common that works well with register renaming is that, well, if we're doing this preprocessing step for instructions anyways, we can also convert these instructions to simpler forms, possibly multiple instructions, so that they're suitable and look like sort of our normal like add, move, simple instructions. So then we went on to our sort of last topic for this course, which is about side channels. And we introduced this idea that we have some way we're expected to get info. So like we had our example from the lab of a function that checks a passphrase and tells you yes or no. And that's kind of the main channel, the main way we're expected to get information. But often we have these side channels, these sort of other ways we can get information, and these side channels can reveal information we are not supposed to have. And we saw that in the lab, that if you were successful, you kind of got the whole passphrase from just having this function that told you yes or no, and not because you were guessing everything, but because you had this side channel of how long the function took. The function wasn't written to tell you that internally, it just checked the passphrase, but you could get that information out of it sort of by accident. And we saw that there are other examples of this. So we had the example of sort of styling information in the browsers and visited links being a problem that they have to deal with, and they dealt with it by saying, well, we just can't give you that information. That can be a side channel. We have to carefully protect against that. And we started by looking at what is sort of one of the more powerful side channels, which is using timing information to learn about what's in the cache. And we're going to learn today that this has some pretty bad implications for our out-of-order processors in particular. So before I start to introduce like what's going to go wrong with out-of-order processors and learning what's in the cache, some questions about things we covered last time. So we're going to look at figuring out what's in the cache. And kind of our central intuition is that we can look at how long it takes to access things, and that tells us whether or not something is still in the cache. And we can use this usefully to kind of infer what happens when we access something that might evict something from the cache. So we're going to use this trick to figure out what some code that doesn't actually tell us what it accesses. So in particular, here, we could look at what happens to the cache and figure out information about what the other address is. That's going to tell us something about that memory access, even though we aren't like explicitly checking other addresses value directly. And we learned that if something is evicted from the cache, that tells us it has a different tag, the same and the same cache index as other address. So we learn some bits of other address. We don't learn the whole thing, and kind of immediately this doesn't seem super useful, but it turns out that this is extremely useful. And partly because of some scenarios that are set up by out-of-order processors, this is useful way more often than you would expect. So on note, we're going to talk about this, and I'm going to ignore some rather important practical concerns in actually taking advantage of this information. So one practical concern is that caches typically use physical addresses and not virtual addresses. This is a problem to do this, but it's a surmountable one because it turns out OSs assign physical addresses in predictable ways, where you can figure out what the physical addresses are in some other way. That in this code here, I was kind of assuming that this code that accesses all of the array and times it doesn't interfere with the cache in a way that will give us kind of false signals. That will happen in practice, right? There's other stuff going on, like the loop that I implement to time the thing might access the cache too and evict other things. That is a problem. We can deal with that by, like, you know, timing other things and seeing what's evicted to learn sort of what our noise from our measurements and other activity are. Another issue is that processors like avoiding cache misses by doing some limited guessing of what you're about to access, and that can disrupt this, and that's a problem. You just have to arrange to not trigger that when you don't want to. Another issue is that it turns out some caches don't actually use index bits. They take a hash function of part of the upper bits of the address, and that's a problem for some practical use of this, but it's a surmountable. So assuming we've solved those issues, so we're going to assume all physical addresses, we don't have to worry about other things interfering. Let's say I know where pointer is, and I want to figure out what the value of mystery, whether mystery is true or false, that is, not the exact value, just whether it's true or false. And my idea is that, okay, I'm going to load my entire array into the cache. I've allocated it in sort of a contiguous set of physical addresses, so that's going to fill up the cache. Absolutely everything in the cache is going to be filled. And when we access that pointer, if it goes into the cache, it has to evict part of the array. So I can just check to see, is that part of the array evicted or not? If the answer is yes, then the pointer access must have happened. If the answer is no, it must not have. So what array index should I check? And we have a sphere, so I'll give you a little time to work on that. Who'd like some more time? A few people. So I'll go through my process for an answer here. So assuming this function allocates a line memory, which is what it says it does, that means it should be a multiple of the cache size, which means its tag is something, but the index and offset at the beginning of the array are 0. Because if it's a multiple of the cache size, we have 15 bits that are all zeros, and our cache has 9 index bits, 6 offset bits. So this means that array index array of x, we can just get the index from x and the offset from x, sort of treating it as, just the index and offset part, because, well, when we add it to the base of the array, we're just changing the index and offset are 0 plus x. Because they started at 0. So I just need to figure out what index and offset in the array should we check, and once we know that, we can compute the x by just converting that back to the number x. And if I look at this pointer's address, I have my offset is going to be 8, and my index is going to be this value here, which turns out to be 110, also known as 6. Or alternately, I can say that any index that looks like, so we have array of x where x equals, something that has this sort of pattern at the end, because that's the index and offset bits. So it's going to have index of 6 and, well, we don't actually need to match the offset bits because anything in the block will work. So anything with the index of 6, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3. Is that correct number of bits? So we need to have 9 bits here, and then anything for the remaining 6 bits, and then that would be our index. So we can come up with a bunch of numbers that work. It's anything that has those index bits, that middle 9 bits matching, that's going to be part of array that goes to the same set of the cache, right? We just want to get the right set, and that will do it. So questions on how I figure that out? So we're just matching the set index. I don't change the tag because the array is not big enough for me to change the tag, right? If I choose a number that has a tag of 1 for x, that's going to increase the tag by 1, which wouldn't be a problem except we'll go out of bounds. And the offset doesn't matter. As long as it's, any offset's going to be part of the same cache block, it's going to be evicted and slow if the pointer was accessed. Yes.
So we're only checking one pointer, right? Like the whole block being accessed will tell us that it, like that pointer, right, would be accessed.
So the question: we're only checking. There's only one pointer here, but we're looking at the whole block. So the way our caches work, in order to read something into a cache, we have to replace the whole block. So the whole block will be replaced, so we can look at any of the 64 bytes that was replaced, and they, any of them should show us slower.
Is it possible for like, well, it wouldn't be possible, because this is what's running, for something else to also like evict that cache, right?
Would it be possible for something else to evict it? So I need to assume here, and I guess one of the things I didn't put in the previous slide is another consideration is if there's other things on the machine, yep, that could interfere too. But we're going to assume, to keep things simple, that we know exactly what code is running. Because otherwise, yeah. So that much just extra work. Other question, yeah? Can I explain once again how I got the answer? So the key insight is that our array starts at index 0, offset 0. We need to choose an index into the array that advances it to set index 6 in this case, because that matches the pointer. And so I just need to put 6 times 64 plus some any offset I choose to do that. So I want 6 in my index bits of the index, because it's an array of bytes. And then anything in the offset bits will work. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so it seems like by choosing the correct index, we figured out what the whether mystery is true or false. But it turns out and I have my other explanation for this here. We haven't. And the reason why is we have branch prediction. And especially on an out-of-order processor, branch prediction can start running that pointer access far enough that the cache eviction happens. And that probably seems a bit inconvenient, but in fact, if you're trying to take advantage of these side channels, we'll find out that this is very convenient, even though in this scenario, it kind of made this not work. Because it's going to let other things that conceptually seem like they shouldn't work happen. So, talk here about kind of inferring whether an access happened. Another thing we can do is we can figure out exactly where an access was. So let's say here, I know where that there's some access to an unknown index of other array here, and I have my sort of testing array, and I find out that at I equals 0x800, it was slow. And let's again assume that we have sort of our 32 KB direct mapped cache with 64 byte blocks, which means we have 9 index bits and 6 offset bits. So the question is, what's the value of mystery? Or a value of mystery? Turns out we don't know the exact value. We just know some information about it. So can someone tell me what's a good first step for solving this? Or it'd be something that would be useful for me to do. So figuring out how this value and this and maybe this value split up into index and offset bits. Yeah, so that seems useful. And I can find out that we have, in this case, that we have a bunch of stuff, and then we have 0. Here's our index bits and our, oh, I'll do this here. So this is 0x200400. If I write it in binary, sort of, I get a bunch of stuff that's the tag. It turns out we're not going to really care about the tag very much, and an index and offset bits. So, and I'll also convert 0x800 that way, and we find out that it has a value that looks like this. So, yeah, and that's a very good first step. So I just sort of set up the index and offset bits parts. I haven't written all of the tag part for the array, other array base address. But just for space mainly. Okay. So that's a useful first step. And the reason why is that something we can say is that other array plus the mystery value has the same set as array plus I. So what we want to do is we want to do some algebra and figure out what is the value of mystery that makes that the set indexes match. So we want to do, and I have here the logic filled out, we take our mystery value here, which I'll represent as x, and I just want to solve, you know, how I can get it have the same set as array at I. So I just solve to have figure out what's the bit pattern that could be in mystery, and I find out that I know what the set index bits are. I don't actually know anything about any of the other bits. So I don't learn the whole value, but I learn, in this case, 9 bits of the value. Questions? Yes. So you've learned some bits of the value. And so this seems like a nice curiosity. We're going to have a way of turning this into more than just a curiosity later. So another thing I'd like to bring up, we won't go into kind of detailed explanation, but let's go say we have a two-way cache. So far I've been thinking of a direct map cache, and we find only one thing is evicted and it's deterministic. We can still do this with a multi-way cache. So if we go back to our first problem, we wanted to match a particular pointer here. Remember in the old version, we said we check index 0, 1, 180, and that would be what was evicted, always. In this version, we have to check two indices, so it's going to be 0 and 0 plus something where we increment the tag by 1. And why are we doing that? It's because we know that there are two things that map to the same set in the array. We want to check both of them because either of them could have gotten evicted. So this is how we deal with a multi-way cache where we don't have one place that definitely gets evicted. We can just check both of the possibilities, or if there's 4 ways, all 4 of the possibilities. Yes?
You mentioned earlier that if you increment the tag, they
Okay, you mentioned earlier that if we increment the tag bit, we can out-of-bounds the array. So this was true in our earlier example here, because the cache size, right, the way the cache size worked is that this was, if we think of index and offset, this was exactly a one, you know, a value number with a tag of one, index offset of zero. With a two-way cache, we're going to end up having it be look like this, because having two ways with the same size basically means that we have half the number of sets. So we won't go out of bounds by incrementing the tag by one anymore. Does that answer your question? So another way of thinking about it is that when we increase the number of ways, we're kind of, in keeping the cache size the same, we're kind of, you know, reducing the number of index bits and increasing the number of tag bits. So we'll have more tag bits in our array indices. Okay, some questions? Okay. So what I've shown you before has a name in the literature about side channel attacks called prime thrust group. So, and this is the pattern we're going to use. It turns out this is not the only way people try to figure out what cache accesses happen, but it's one I'm going to use because I think it's one of the easier ones to explain. So it's called prime thrust probe because we have this prime step where we fill the cache with known values, and a probe step where we access those values again to see if they got evicted. And this was originally coined in attacks on AES encryption, where it turned out the information we got from this was really useful and kind of broke several AES implementations. And kind of the reason why is that the early AES implementations had a scenario that kind of looked like this one, where we had an access to some array at a mystery index, where the mystery index was very useful. In particular, early AES implementations used lookup tables, and the input to that lookup table would be something like part of the key. And actually worse than that, it would be like part of the key XORed with part of the data to be encrypted. So if you had some system where you could change what data was encrypted, and a practical example is you're running as a normal user in a system with full disk encryption. So it encrypts everything you write to disk, so you can encrypt whatever you want encrypted over and over and over again. You can use this to figure out the index in the table. Not all the index, but the part of the index that is in the set index bits. Right? We learn part of that value, not all the offset bit part, but part of it. And because you can kind of vary the index by changing your data, you can use this to like read out basically bits of the secret information being used to compute the index. And as an example, here's a graph from the sort of one of the early papers on this. And here they have their raw timing data. Basically, they probed and computed the time for every part of their probing array, the priming array. And here they subtracted out the average times to get rid of, there's normal accesses that use parts of the cache. They subtracted out the average times to get sort of what changed between different encryptions. And as they were doing these encryptions, they changed the value of one of the data bits. And you can see here that we can figure out, we're basically taking that, adding something, and that's a table index. And we can see the table index through what's evicted here, changing as we change that index. And it turns out that that tells us part of the key, and you could use this to basically infer enough of the key to compromise basically the whole key by doing this over and over. And you might ask, how do we defend against this? If you're implementing AES in software, the defense is that if you want to implement it securely, you never use lookup tables, even though it's slower. So questions? So we know that this is practical, kind of this AES scenario, and we're going to talk about kind of a more general version of this attack that is known as Spectre. And to introduce that, we'll do this sort of example where we have things nicely set up, where I've somehow, you know, have my access nicely multiplied by a big number. So in this case, if we find out array of 4000 is slow to access, we know that mystery times block size has the same index bits as this. So we know that mystery is equal to 400 divided by the block size. And this is a fact we're going to use over and over again, which is why I mentioned it. So we're going to use this fact over and over again, and we're going to use it with kind of our issue that we had there, where we were initially saying, oh, can we detect the access to pointer? Yes, but it doesn't actually tell us whether mystery is true, because we have kind of branch prediction where this move might happen and then get undone. The copy reading from pointer might happen, be undone, and that should, yeah, and that's going to be a problem for us. And we're going to take advantage of that we can have this access happen kind of when it's not supposed to. And we can actually make this more or less likely to happen. So how can we do that? So if I have something false here, how can I make this more likely that the pointer access happens? So what determines whether this pointer access happens? Yeah. So what happened? So something false determines whether it finishes. But we learned that the cache access happens even sometimes based on branch prediction. So what I want to do is, I know that this statement is false. How can I make it be mispredicted more often? So what are some ideas for how could we do that? So we've learned a little bit about branch prediction. What would make it more likely to be mispredicted? Yeah. So if we're using a static predictor, we can make it look like it would be, you know, above. Okay. Other ideas? Yeah.
I guess we could set up our own branch that caches the same thing.
Okay. So we know that dynamic branch predictors kind of use this kind of hash to a table idea. We could deliberately create a conflict in that table and make the conflicting branch be predicted as taken. And the processor uses the history, finds out it should be able to be taken, and mispredicts it consistently. That's one approach. Yeah?
You could add more conditions to it. So, like, say, instead of only taking that branch if, like, the last one was false, you can say, like, take this branch if, like, the last 10 instances were false, and that would make it less likely to access the pointer.
So I guess we could change the branch predictor. I agree. We're going to talk about software changes. You're talking about changing. So another thing we can do is that usually in practice, you know, this might be this. If the same branch is used multiple times, it might be true sometimes, but not when we're trying to access pointer. So we could run it in a bunch of cases where it doesn't end up accessing the same pointer, but the branch, something false is true, and we'll see that example. And so the reason why we're going to want to care about making branch mispredictions happen is that we're going to look at this format of attack, where basically we access something in a mispredicted branch. And we can find the value of some mystery value. And I think the first kind of context that this was really discovered in was because there was an interesting observation about something that Intel processors did. Now, if you had code like this, so we have the prime and probe, and we have a branch that won't happen, but it's going to be mispredicted, and we can arrange for it to be mispredicted. And in this branch, we have a seg fault, and then we do something. And our question here is, well, can that something after the seg fault still happen? And the answer is, on an out-of-order processor, absolutely. Because the seg fault is unrelated to that something, the processor will continue past the seg fault. It won't actually continue past it, but it basically will run the use of pointer sometimes before it detects the seg fault. Because it's running instructions in whatever order their values are available, if the values to cause the seg fault aren't available soon, the seg fault won't be detected until after the other stuff in the branch is actually computed and we do like memory accesses and so on. And this turned out to be particularly useful on Intel processors, which made the bizarre decision that in the virtual address lookup, they separated the two steps of translating the address and checking the permission bits. So the checking of the permission bits and triggering a seg fault was a separate step from actually doing the address translation. And this meant that you could write code like this, where you fill up the cache, you do something that reads memory you're not allowed to read, and you access something in an array based on that. And of course, that code would seg fault if it actually ran, but we aren't actually running it. It's in a mispredicted branch, so it's going to be canceled. So there's no seg fault. Great. And it's going to be canceled, so like we'll never actually be able to directly access value. If we try to change the array, the changes will be undone. But the accesses to the array will get far enough that they'll evict something from the cache. So, and we can set up our access deliberately so that the index bits tell us the whole value, right? We don't have that problem anymore that I only learn about some of the middle bits. I can move them by multiplying to wherever I need them. Okay, question? So the question is, why would we get here if we don't have an, if your question is, if how did the processor run this without having first figured out that the branch isn't taken, or?
I meant, so, because if we actually run the line, read memory bars non-readable, then it's going to seg fault, right?
But question, if we actually run this line, it's going to seg fault? So, yes, if we actually run that, it will seg fault. On Intel processors, it turned out that the way that was implemented in sort of the out-of-order system is that kind of these steps of getting the value at that memory address and checking whether you were allowed to get the value were separate.
So it needs to happen in a very deliberate way that it will first try to look for that value and the Intel processor tell you that value first and before it verifies it, it actually got far.
So it needs to happen in a way where the Intel processor tells you that value before it verifies it gets far enough? Yes, with the caveat that the processor doesn't really tell us the value. The reason why the Intel designers felt this was safe is because the processor doesn't like reveal the values to you until it verifies them. The issue here is that even though it doesn't reveal them through a main channel, it reveals them through this side channel of the cache. So the main channel would be like you can't like putting that value in a register, right? The processor won't ever do that usefully because by the time you get to code where you like output the value of that register, it'll undo all those instructions. So the problem was that it didn't undo the cache access completely. Does that answer your question? So basically, the sort of fundamental problem here is that we're doing speculative execution. We're guessing what should happen. And when the guess is wrong, we don't undo all the effects of that guess. And that means that we have this side channel that leaks information about what was happening when we were guessing. And it turns out that when we're making guesses like, you can access this memory you're not supposed to access, that information is definitely stuff you aren't supposed to have. Some questions? Yeah. Is there some way to record what things we evict and un-evict them? That is among the sort of strategies for mitigating this problem in hardware. It is not trivial, right? Because if we're going to record what we evicted, that means we have to limit how much stuff we evict to how much space we have to record, and that means branch misprediction recovery is slower, things like that. Okay, so this vulnerability was known as Meltdown. And this is the code from the paper that they used to exploit it. And what they're doing here is they set a value to zero. They have this, this is all in something that's not really supposed to run. This is in a mispredicted if statement that has that something false, but it's predicted to happen. And they have this loop that until they read a non-zero value, tries to keep reading the value and then accesses some known array that's going to evict something from the cache. The reason they repeatedly checked for zero value was that they learned that the speculation, the guessing the Intel processors did would use zero if they didn't have a value yet. So they just kept trying until it got a non-zero value and then went through. And all this code would end up running kind of in that if something false. So it wouldn't matter that this line, if it actually executed outside of branch misprediction with segfault, because, well, it was in branch misprediction. It never gets to complete anyways. Questions? Here. Yeah? How do you have that many instructions running in the branch misprediction? So in an out-of-order processor, we have an instruction queue. And it turns out for sort of modern laptop and desktop processors, that instruction queue has many tens of entries. So in a branch misprediction, even based on just what's the instruction queue, we can easily go many tens of instructions ahead. And if you look at the capacities of other data structures, it usually turns out we can, in some scenarios, get well over 100 instructions ahead. So if we want to make this more likely, we want to try to make it like take a long time for the processor to figure out the branch is mispredicted. We can do that by like having it be the result of a slow memory access or something like that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this clearly was a problem and how it was fixed somehow. Oh, also, they happen to be multiplying not by the cache block size, but by 4K, because that avoided triggering the prefetch. I mentioned that was a problem. So what was the fix for this? Well, the hardware fix is to do what everyone but Intel was doing and have the address translation and permissions check be the same step. So you can't translate an address that you don't have permission to access. A software solution, because people had Intel processors with this problem and you wanted to continue using them, was that you had the page tables for kernel code and user code be separate, which means you have to switch page tables every time you go into the kernel and go out, which turns out to be a lot slower in some systems, but that's how you fix it, or work around it in software. And if this were the only kind of problem with these side channels revealing information, we probably wouldn't have this topic in this course, but this is the simple one to fix. There's a much worse one. Which I'm going to show with this code that here. So if we have some code that looks like this, where we check whether X is in bounds, and if it is, we access some other array based on reading from X and a value. And what's this going to do? Well, this index, sort of index, depends on array one of X here. And that means that if we figure out, that means that what this evicts depends on the value of array one of X. So if we look at what running this code would evict, that's going to tell us what array one of X is. And another thing is I have this if statement I haven't talked about, but this if statement, we learned, doesn't actually stop the eviction from happening. So the bounds check doesn't work. Like, it works in the sense that we won't actually sort of get the results of the array one access permanently somewhere, won't like actually change Y forever, but it will access the cache. And we can figure out where it accessed that, regardless of whether array one of X is actually in array one. And this means we can deliberately choose an X that goes way out of bounds of array one and to some memory location that is more interesting. And this pattern is sort of one example of kind of a setup vulnerability known as Spectre. And the reason why it's valuable is that we're going to suppose that this is C code like in the kernel or in something that is supposed to have extra access, that this code can access array one of X, us calling this code cannot. So an example of this is the implementation of a system call might have code like this if we're lucky. Seems contrived right now, but we'll talk about why it's not so much. And we can call it and trigger it to evict something from the cache based on our chosen value of X. And that lets us read memory from anywhere. So, that's an example here. So let's say there's this secret value here that's stored in memory at this address, and we know where array one is. What X should we choose to cause this eviction to tell us about the value? Anyone who hasn't talked yet, we're at. I guess my hint here is that this is So our goal here is that array one of x actually accesses secret. How do we make that happen? We can look at where does array one of x access? Well, it accesses array one plus x, and we want that to equal the address of secret. So I just do some, I take my array one address plus my x equals the address of secret, solve for x, and I'm going to get that x is going to be, in this case, 3f0003. Just supply that value of x, and when this code runs, it's going to read from secret. Yes? Would I not have to count for the 496? I do not. So we're going to take the value of secret, and this is going to turn into array 2 of secret times 4096. So what the 4096 is going to do is it's going to affect what's evicted. We haven't gotten to that step yet. So we have something evicted, and exactly what's evicted depends on what secret is. And there's going to be a next step, which is the next exercise about, okay, now that we know what's evicted, how can we figure out, work backwards to secret spelling? Does that answer your question? Okay, so if we run this code, we've evicted something based on the value of secret. So now let's say it evicts from cache set 128 in our cache with 64 byte blocks and 8,192 steps. What do we know about array 1 of x? And to simplify this problem for you, I will point out that it's a character array. You know, we're just talking about one byte, so there's only 256 possible values at most. And we should be able to limit it down to fewer. Okay, who'd like some more time? Couple. Okay, like sort of my key insight to like help figure this out is that array 2 of anything times 64 is going to be in cache set anything mod 192 because of how cache sets work. If array 2 of 0 is cache set 0, array 2 of 64 is cache set 1, array 2 of 128 is cache set 2, and so on until we get to cache set 8191. And in that case, when we advance by 1, we end up going back to 0. Okay, so I'll go through. So I'm using the fact that array 2 of anything time n times 64 goes to set n mod 8192. And that tells us that if it evicted cache set 128, the actual value of this expression needed to be 64 times 2, or 64 times 2 plus some multiple of 8192, the number of sets. Those are two. Oh, that is. I am bad here. Okay. Good work, me. 64 times 128. I'm revealing my hand. So those are possible values. Right, so times 128, because I took set 128, needs to go to array 2 of 64 times 128. That's the first place it is. The next place it is that plus array 2 of 64 times 128 plus 8192 times 64. That I'm advancing by sort of enough to go through all the sets and wrap back around to 0. That's where I get this addition of 8192 times 64. So if I solve for z here, if I use the first possibility, I'm going to get that z equals 2. And if I use the second possibility, I get that z equals 130. If I use the third possibility, I get that z equals 258. And so on, increasing by 128 each time. These we can kind of exclude because they're bigger than the size of a character, they're bigger than a byte, so they're not possible. So my possible answers are that array 2 of x was either 2 or 130. Z equals 128 plus 8192 n. Where do you get?
Well, n just being which
cycle?
You have times 1, times 2, times 3.
So we have 4,000. So here. So I think what you're getting. So let me do exactly that simplification.
That's 49.6 is 2 to the 12. So 64 times 128 would be 2 to the 13.
Equals 64 times 128 plus 64 times 8192 times n.
Yeah, so if you divide it all by 49.6, you can get...
So 49.6 is 64 times 64, so this is 2. And this would be also 2.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, I see.
So when we do that, so another way of doing it is we got z, we divide everything by 2, we got z equals 2 plus 128 n. Or 64 times 2 times it. So which gives us, again, another way of getting our 2 and 130 answers. Another way of thinking about this is that if we look at what the bits of this expression here are, we have 12 bits which are all 0. And then we have our mystery value. And the next 8 bits and our set index bits are going to sort of reveal from 9 bits of this starting here. So that's 6. And we got those bits. And we got those are the set index bits as it maps to the array indexing. So we learn most of the bits of the mystery value. They're just encoded in the set index when we do the computation, and that's, I've just decoded them to get 2 and 130, but I just learned those set index bits, which happen to correspond to, some of which happen to correspond to the value at secret. To the first byte of secret in this case. Some questions? So this came up as, let's go through, we have kind of our steps, and this came to an attack sort of, this which is kind of known as Spectre. There's some other variations of it, but this is kind of the arguably simplest one. And my idea is that we have some system call, you know, that runs in kernel mode. It has extra permissions. In particular, it has permission to access this memory that we're not allowed to access because we assume we fixed Meltdown. And it has our vulnerable code. And what we're going to do is first, we're going to run this code normally. And the reason for doing that is we have this if statement here that's checking if X is in bounds. And we want the branch predictor to be really sure that it is. So we'll just run that repeatedly, and the branch predictor looks for patterns. The pattern is every time that if statement runs, we go inside it. Then we're going to do our kind of actual attack call, and we're going to supply our out of bounds value of X. That's going to choose our target value. And we're going to see that this is going to run long enough, far enough, it's not going to complete, but it's going to get far enough to actually evict something from the cache. We'll figure out what that was. And the system call won't be the wiser, because as far as it was concerned, this if statement, you know, the inside of this if statement never ran, even though it really ran a net partially, but it looks like to the code around it that it didn't run, right? Y doesn't have a value that's set by that, for example. Questions about this? So hopefully we can kind of understand what's going on here, except there's something that makes this seem very contrived, which is that why would I ever write this system call handler? Why would a system call do this exact stuff that's really convenient for this attack? Surely we don't write operating systems that way. We don't provide a system call to please let me peek at memory I'm not supposed to access. And while we don't deliberately do that, but there's some things that happen in reality that are going to make this more practical. So one thing is that you might say, well, even if we have code that looks like this, surely we don't have this part, right? The times 4096 was really useful to make sure the access went to the set index bit so we could get the useful value, right? If we didn't do that, it would all be in the offset bits. We wouldn't really learn anything. But this is kind of like, you can think of it as bit shifting the value, you know, and that was useful to learn the bits. But if we don't do that, we still learn some of the bits of array of X. And in particular, if we have like an array of integers, the bits we learn, the things that match to the set index bits, are still going to be useful bits, and we can still read whatever we want. We just need to do a little extra work to make sure the value we read is in the upper bits of the address we choose. So for example, if I want memory at address 1000, I don't set array 1 of X to 1000, I set it to a value a little less, so when we read an integer, the upper bits of that integer are from 10000. Yeah? Why must we have this instead of an arbitrary false statement? We don't need one. It could be an arbitrary false statement as long as we can make the branch predictor predict it wrong. The reason why I'm showing this array X less than array one size of X is to make it clear that we're accessing out of the bounds of array one, and also because this is a typical real pattern, as we'll see later. Right? It's actually common in real code to like get array index, check if it's in bounds, then do something. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And then you might say, okay, so that takes care of like why of the, this weird multiply that we don't expect to see. But it turns out we can expect to see the other part. And kind of the way this code usually turns out is that often we'll have some code like this. This is like a real pattern of code we often see in operating systems. We get an index, we check if it's in some bounds of some table, then we look up in the table, and based on the table, we do something, you know, we look up some value and then use it. This is a real pattern that happens a bunch of ways in OSs. The table could be like a list of file descriptors or files on disks, whatever. There's structures the OS is tracking that have numbers that are in tables, and this kind of code pattern happens naturally with them, where we have these two dependent accesses. So like, is this in the table check? That's that mispredicted branch. It's there, here, it's not in the if statement, but the effect's the same, right? If we mispredict it, we keep going on in the function. If we don't, we return right away. And we can fool the processor into starting to run the things that keep going on in the function. We can do our first array lookup that's gonna produce a value into kind, and the processor can start running that. Of course, the value will never really end up in kind, but it will be computed while we're speculating, we're guessing that we keep going in this function. And then we might get far enough to run this second dependent access, and that's going to tell us everything. Yes?
Would this dot foo take us, hold a similar role to the time 4096?
Would the dot foo do a similar role to the 4096? Not really, because this is going to be, the dot foo part is going to be kind of like plus something, but if other table is like an array of structs, that's going to multiply by something, and that could be useful, right? Because if we think about, if other kind is a struct of like, you know, that's like say 1 kilobyte, then we're multiplying by 1K to do that array lookup.
And then we don't have to guess a couple of values.
Then we know bits possibly in a more convenient place, yes. Other questions? So that shows how this exploit pattern here like can come up kind of by accident in real code. Yes, and the other place where it turns out this is a problem is, like I showed this in operating systems, the other place where the original paper revealed this was a problem was web browsers and JavaScript. JavaScript can call functions in the web browser that are supposed to access things. Scripts on a web page aren't supposed to access. But these functions can have the same kind of vulnerabilities. It turns out you can do all this stuff. You could have previously have done all this stuff from JavaScript to read stuff in the web browser. Scripts on a web page aren't supposed to. So that's where I'm going to finish for today. And so next time on the, so we have a quiz that's due next Tuesday. And next Tuesday on the schedule is listed as exam review. The way that's going to work is I am not going to prepare some review slides. I'm going to take your questions and talk about that. So if you don't have any questions, I'll just leave. So please come with questions.